Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Show and Sleeve Show.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take my suit. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, lighten up my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but please don't take my suit.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
I should just sing the open. I should just sing it. Adjust the frequency. Get the right megahertz in. Oh, listening to a little Thelonious Monk. A solo piano. You know, the real connoisseur, the real aficionado. So that it was a toreador type turn of bullfighting. But maybe it is. The real connoisseur of jazz or of music, the deep, wide listener who makes it a daily point to listen to something, to meet with music. They can listen to just a few moments of different things and know who's playing. Just by the sound of the keys being hit, the way, the mode of playing. So, I can't do it, I don't have that. But someone would listen to this and maybe never having heard solo piano by Thelonious Monk, but knowing Monk, would say, oh, that's Thelonious Monk. It's amazing how strong the individual color can be. A thousand different people can play the piano and someone can distinguish between them. That's Garrick Ohlsson. That's Thelonious Monk. I wish I had a long list of piano players I could do a drum roll with, but I don't. So there's a storm coming. It's onset. It's moving in from where it is. It's coming this way. And I don't know why this is, but I always find myself at the store on storm days. I feel as though I'm there simply according to the flow of my visit to the store. But I'm always there when there's a storm coming, and I see the buzzing hive of people stocking up. It never ends, it never doesn't infuriate me a tiny bit, just tiny. So I don't mean that I get angry. But then I look around, and you know, people have filled a whole cart full of water and snacks for a thousand-day imprisonment. And they are manufacturing two very different moods, and they don't seem to recognize one. So the mood or mode that they are putting forth is one of great concern. There's a storm coming and we must stock up. Now, they don't seem, though, to recognize that underlying that is a great deal of excitement. That, honestly, they can't wait to be slammed by this storm, for everything to be thrown up in a heaval. Topsy-turvy. Here comes topsy-turvy. Here comes the upheaving, the uprising, the revolutionary, what's going to happen today, day. They seem only to be aware of the burden part. And yet that excitement fills them, energizes them. They're hunters, they're collecting, they're getting ready, and there's a sparkle in their eye. I think what upsets me is that no one can see this make-believe aspect, that really everyone's just having a great, could be having a great deal of fun. That secretly that's the wavering that best is at hand. Not concerned that we're all going to die in the great 12-inch snowstorm of 2012. Sometimes there are long pauses in this program. If you haven't heard it before, occasionally there are stretches of who knows what. Unnarrated documentary film, where the wild animals just chase each other or sit in the tree, or the canoe goes down the river and no one's talking. One thing that's never, or that I don't know if it's been tried, I doubt it, but I can't watch sporting events on television because of the incessant talking. There was someone on the radio 15 years ago who used to do the Red Sox games, and they were relatively quiet. They said all the things that happened, but then they seemed to fall asleep in between the events. They'd say, here comes old so-and-so up to bat. Pitcher throws. It's another strike. And then there's that period of time in baseball where nothing's happening. The batter has to go through superstitious motions of reaffixing his glove and tapping his forearm. And the pitcher has to stare down into the sunlight of the catcher's mitt to see the secret code of the next pitch. The umpire waddles around and then takes his position and then freezes and then crouches and then watches. So during that interim between actions, this commentator, this play-by-play person, would be fairly quiet. There's nothing happening, so why say anything? But I would like more of that. I think that it does room for a lot more quiet in the accompaniment of these sporting events. Let's just hear the people, the crowds, or not, some music. Just watch the event for a while, a minute. And then the announcers can come in when something dramatic happens and they can be excited. It's not to turn down the emotional level of the thing. But to just switch the emphasis just for a moment. I seem to be pushing that as a way of defending my own occasional long lapses where the canoe drifts down the river and the monkeys fall asleep in the trees, none of the birds are singing, and no one's saying anything about anything. The other night I went out, a sort of coincidental experience as alongside a thought I was having, and most people know about this, but if you look up into the sky, there are certain stars that you can't see with the direct center of your eye. These are peripheral type stars. The type of low level of light that they're emitting can only be perceived by the side of the eye. So in order to see it, you have to not look directly at it. You have to shift your gaze, perhaps 90 degrees away. And then if you shift back, it disappears. There are many of these peripheral vision stars. I also drink tea. And I take a moment to do that. So there's that. The peripheral vision of stars. And in the meantime, I've been reading. I don't know what you would call it. I suppose. Spiritual parapsychology type book. It's a book about Seth, written by Jane Roberts, or transcribed by, actually, her husband Robert Butts, spoken by Jane Roberts. I don't want to go into the whole Seth thing, but if you know about Seth, you know about Seth. If you don't, I'll briefly describe it. I think in the late or early 60s, Jane Roberts began investigating ESP phenomenon with her husband, Robert Butts. And over the course of their research, she became a channel for a multidimensional being who called himself Seth, and who he began speaking through her voice, taking over her body for periods of time, and talking about the universe and the way of things in an almost godlike fashion, but somewhere between God and a man. I have my doubts and I have my skepticisms, but I try to leave them aside because there are many things that are very compelling about what Seth says. So even if Jane Roberts is enacting some sort of schizoid break and is unearthing some element of her subconscious, there's a great deal of very fine articulation and coherence. So there is perhaps the question of what is happening. Is she actually channeling a multidimensional being? Or is she somehow unearthing something from her own consciousness? That's one thing to wonder. But then second is, what actually is she saying? So those are separate concerns, and they can be looked at without even really any connection, is what this Seth person saying of interest, meaningful, of value. Now, I'm not going to continue on in what Seth is and what I think specifically, but only to say there are some things that you cannot look at directly. You cannot look at the sun, or you should not look at the sun directly, unless it's sunset. Should you know, you can look at the sun 16 minutes before it sets. There's some period of time. Don't look at it 16 minutes before, because it may be 14 minutes before. Find out before you go stare at it. There's a period of time before it sets when it's safe to study. But for the most of the day, you should not, or you'll burn a tiny little anthill in the center of your brain, and all the ants will crawl in and live there. So you can't look at the sun directly, and you can't see certain stars directly, and there are certain things in the world that you should not attempt to study with the front part of your mind, with the leading edge that you tend to bring toward everything. The part that solves math problems, the part that directs you into town, the part that looks into the faces of the people at the store who are stocking up and senses their mania. You have to look at such things peripherally. Set aside that problem-solving part of yourself, and it's difficult to do. It can be. There are some people who are made who will look at the entire world peripherally. That's all they ever do. But I do think we tend to forget, and we use our same mode of thinking with everything that comes our way, whether we're going to fix our car, whether we're going to write a card to our Aunt Agatha, whether we're going to figure out where we should live or what our job should be or who we are. We come at it head on, as though we're trying to ride some horse. And there are most of the things in our world aren't horses that we can ride. Most of the things in our world are peripheral stars. They are the sun that we cannot stand to stare at. So anyway, this evening we have two little bits to play. A walk that I took during a rainy, rainy rainstorm, or just a plain rainstorm. Rain plane storm. Occasionally you do go out and it is raining plain. Now, what I mean by that is that the air is dull. There are some days that are just shot in the gut. And you can't do anything about it. It's a dead, dead day. There's a day when you try to dig a hole and the shovel melts. And still splinters in your hand. So, but I go for a walk and it's rainy, rainy day. And then we, after a long absence, we have a short bit by Sean. Something he did for the radio on his visit to Woodstock, Vermont, which is, according to Time magazine, one of the top most Christmassy places in the country, top 9 most Christmassy places in the country. How what they used to discover this, it's, I'm sure, not a scientific procedure. He just looked around and picked some things, probably over the course of 30 minutes, but that's all right. Well, why don't we do that first? Here's Sean's visit to Woodstock, Vermont.
So we were driving along toward Christmas in a rinky mix of slush and ice and half-baked snowflakes. It seemed to me that sand was falling too, if that's possible. My son smelled like peppermint sticks, my wife like a Christmas tree, and I smelled vaguely of prisoners, because I was wearing my old sweater. Now maybe prisoners don't smell like my old sweater, but that's how I was feeling. Not too sunny. More Grinch than Santa. More early Scrooge than late. And yet, here we were, heading into the very heart of Christmas. The first thing we did when we got to Woodstock was not park for a long time. We shuffled along behind the other latecomers, hoping we wouldn't miss the great Wassail Parade, which I called Wassail, my wife called Wessel, and my son called Waffles. But we parked finely beside a dry riverbed somewhere near the moon and dashed along until we crossed a covered bridge and found ourselves there, on Main Street in Woodstock, as close to the substance that Time magazine might call Christmassiness as you can get.
Clover Maple Farm of Cumberston, 10 of their ice
The Wassail Parade is a horse parade, both medieval and Dickensian. No batons are twirled, no dancing clowns. It's a stately, dreamlike affair. The riders wear holiday costumes or period garb. There are lots of top hats and flowing capes and feathers. But despite the spectacle, I still wasn't feeling it, as this secret surveillance audio I obtained from myself reveals as I snuck away to get coffee and left my recorder on.
I wouldn't touch you with a 39.5 foot pole.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a dear. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
While I was a bad banana with a greasy black peel, my wife and son have been filled with this excelsior of Christmas spirit since before Thanksgiving, a kind of golden, glittery mood that had passed me by entirely. "Christmas is in here, son," the old-timer tells the jaded kid in every Christmas classic. Then he taps the kid right on the Christmas heart with his Christmas finger.
"Just remember, the true spirit of Christmas lies in your heart."
"Not in my heart, Tom Hanks, Santa Claus." We went along next to the church to listen to the a cappella singing group, The Ten. They sang beautifully, and to be fair, we did arrive a little late, and so I guess we stumbled upon the tropical medley section of the performance.
"Down in Jamaica, they've got lots of pretty women. Steal your money and they'll break your heart.
This isn't very Christmassy."
I was trying my hardest, but it kept going on and on. While I didn't have a useful old-timer to jab me in the Christmas heart, the wassail schedule showed that they were going to set fire to the Yule log and light the massive memory tree and sing Christmas carols on the green. Even the stoniest among us would have to soften. There was a little feedback problem until the old accordion player blasted the wicked circularity into oblivion. It wasn't the accordion player's fault. He was very good and jolly. The fire was vast and warm. The tree was triangular and tall and well lit. Everyone was smiling and crowding the fire and very Christmassy. But for some reason, that accordion was shooting rusty daggers directly into my head.
"There's one thing I hate. All the noise.
It would have been right there if I'd been a green cartoon character and had a sled and lived on Mount Crumpet, that I would have tied some antlers to my left boot and headed down into Whoville to see some who's about a what that I hope to not. Everyone's singing, all pressed close, the fire bright, a deep-eyed yellow, the tree glowing with memories, the accordion bullets shooting into my head. And that's when it hit me. Woodstock was Whoville, and I was the Grinch. Look, some years you're sliding down the chimney. You're always merry and always bright. But some years, you're racing down Mount Crumpet. If you're ever going to have your heart grow two sizes too big, you have to let it also be two sizes too small. But clarity is helpful. Knowing you're the Grinch, you can just relax. There's nothing you can do that will stop those who's from singing. The word of mouth. High atop Mount Crumpet, I'm Sean Hurley.
Welcome, welcome, Fahura Moose, welcome. Welcome Christmas, bring your cheer. Fa hu fa res, da hu do res. Welcome all who's far and near. Welcome Christmas, fa hu ra mus.
Welcome Christmas, da hu da mus.
Christmas Day will always be just so long as we have we.
And thank you for that, you old Grinch. Now the snow has started. We're all packed in the car, and we're heading off for a long ride straight into the night. Each of us in turn takes a moment to be the lookout, make sure we're going where we need to go. When it's your turn, you look out through the warm air, the car, through the windshield, and see the billions and billions of snowflakes circling in the headlights of the car. And then when we've all had our turns, we lay back comfortable in great warm jackets, and the car air becomes cold, and there's still a feeling of motion in the roof above our heads. Very slowly dissolves into sky. All those snowflakes now are invisible, but you feel them very delicately touching down on your face and scratching at your jacket and catching in your hat. And you know that no matter how cold, these tiny, melting, perfect bits of ice are, you will always be warm. And then very slowly, above the invisible snowflakes, the bank of clouds somehow inverts and turns to air. And it's as though billions of snowflakes have become the billions of stars. And you're warm. And you're not alone. You sink into the earth. Here's a little walk I took the other day in the rain. Not many people go out walking in the rain. Improperly dressed, without an umbrella or light at night. And step in puddles, get their feet wet. And call it normal. People don't believe me when I say I don't mind getting wet. I don't mind being a little cold. I don't mind when my feet get wet. You get to the point where you like sensation. You like warming up later. You like the hardness, the harshness of the elements. Being oppressed, being pushed at. I don't need always to be dry. I don't need always to be warm. I don't want those things always. I like variation. And there's such pleasure. It almost seems masochism. Oh, wet. There's such pleasure in getting home, taking the wet things off, the cold things off, and then sitting in front of the fire. That, it's almost a blessing. It's almost holy. And the only way to get there is this. But of course, I'm not doing this because I'm not enduring a pain. Though there are parts of feeling cold and having wet feet that aren't exactly merry. Most of it. I accept and rather enjoy, in my strange way, I suppose, if we must put a tilt on it. I don't know if you can hear these puddles I'm stepping into. And you can't, of course, see my boots, but they let the water in like a pair of leaky old rowboats. In fact, I feel the water before I hear it, which I don't know if there's a physics law that allows that, the Bernoulli principle. It's quite opposite, though, the old experience of seeing the distant baseball player hit the ball and then hearing the sound a moment later. This is feeling the ice water on the feet, then hearing the splash. Poor sound comes in last all the time. Sound can't win in the battle of happenings and experience. Can't win baseball, it can't win with wetting the shoes. And maybe if you had the right boots, it could win. Sound frowns at my bad boots. Och, bik, bek, serdite, nas, paraban. So it's the wintry mix, ongoing, diffusing. The wintry mix being certain percentage raindrop, certain percentage bag of slush, some little Ziploc bags full of slush, and then perfect, pristine diamond cut elements of snow. So snowflakes, raindrops, and bags of slush all falling all around. That's the wintry mix. It's the mixed grill of precipitation. It's pork, chicken, sausages, and steak, ribeyes, all bombing down from the grumpy, confused clouds. Now, I don't think the clouds are pleased with this. They don't like a wintry mix. They like clarity. They like to be sure. They like to, we're doing rain, let's do the rain. All right, everyone, it's going to be snow. We're ready. Ready? Now. And then the snow falls. Those clouds are up there now, miserable. Looking up, looking all around, taking measurements, wondering if things are changing. It's getting a little colder. Here comes the snow. Oh, warming up. Slush. Oh, rain. I anthropomorphize whatever I like. Some people have an antipathy for that. They don't like when you put any kind of human or human expression, feeling, characteristic on anything. They don't like you to suggest that animals have any likeness to people, clouds, storms, nothing. That simply seems a matter of pride. That isn't to say that that being anthropomorphic in one's description or mode is accurate, but simply that it is fun. And I think it speaks to a higher sense of similarity. So it might seem, on a small scale, anthropomorphic to suggest that the clouds act in a human way, that they are not pleased to be confusingly dropping different types of thing, variously cold water, some very cold and crystalline, some rather warm and bag-like. But on a higher level, let's assume for argument's sake, the storm and myself are all a part of a pattern, or a pattern that replicates in similar fashion, that does things in not too different a way. As we do things, as monkeys do them, it's not that different. We might have a particular flair. And there may be a great deal of surface difference in the subtle difference between us and the other creatures, between us and clouds. But underlying, it's the same engine, same mechanisms, churning, spinning our atoms, doing similar things to the atoms in the clouds. This is what I think. So when I anthropomorphize, in some ways I'm really being colourful and universal. but it can seem that I'm naming the clowns John, Phil and Harry, and saying they're like out-of-work mariners down at the docks waiting for the next ship to come in. Trying to keep these walks short enough. I don't want them to be 20 minutes long. So let's call that it. Wintry mixed grill. Don't like umbrellas. Don't like coats. Don't like to be too warm. Feet wet. Go home. Blessing. Holy. Then straight to bed. No matter what, straight to bed. I'll confess, there's no such thing as straight to bed for me. There's no straight to anything for me. There's always discursion. I perseverate all about. It takes me forever to get to bed. I rise from the fire. I say to myself, straight to bed. 2 hours later, I'm fiddling around with books on the shelf. But I'm old, I only need a few hours sleep, so it works out. And then I don't have to wake up in the morning to work, so it's all right. It's nice, though, to say to oneself, straight to bed, and not mean it, and not even know that one doesn't mean it. It's like juggling. We'll juggle all these lies and live in two separate ways, and both of them, both of these ways please us. It's pleasing for me to say, oh, straight to bed, and then it's pleasing for me not to do it. I get the best of both worlds, and the both of best worlds. I wonder if that means something. Sometimes I wish I had a poet friend close. As poets are great diviners of mistaken abstractions. Sometimes I misspeak and I wonder if it means anything, and I know if E. Cummings was around, he could say right away, oh yes, that means something. The both of best worlds? Of course. Beautiful. Lovely. Can I steal it? Straight to bed. I really can't explain all the jazz numbers. It's just in a short jazz jag. I don't really like the word jag as expressing a fierce, sudden tendency. But I do like alliteration. So jazz jag. Tea, it's time to sip it. Oh, I'd love to be in charge of a nation of tea sippers. King of the tea. That's what they call me. look out over the kingdom. Ladies and gentlemen, I would say, drink your tea. They'd all raise their cups. A little tea pinky would shoot out. You know the tea pinky. Those cups that sit in the saucers, I suppose you call them china, very fine china, with a picture of a lilac on the side. A short cup, there's not even very much liquid in it, fragile. An English lady cup. You can't pick one of those up without your pinky fingers shooting out to the side like a very boring lightning bolt to the side. So the storm is coming. The jazz is sometimes playing. We're almost to the next year. The world didn't end. I do believe it was supposed to end. And by that I mean, whenever it's supposed to end, no matter who says it, what evidence they give, I like to go along with it and say, yes, I suppose it will too. But another thought that I have alongside that is that I sometimes wonder if the world doesn't end almost constantly and then restart. Every single day, it's in a constant state of shutting off, shutting down, blinking out, and every single day, some equal and opposite force prevents it. And that in itself you might call many things. You could call it time. You could call it space. Sometimes I think time is simply the medium, the symptom of things being apart. So if one rock is distant from another rock, the only way it can happen is with time. So there it is. There can be no distinction or separation without there being travel, without there being any time. Oh, but I'm not a chrono-ocular. Chrono-ocularist. Just laying out here on this windy hill with you all. Do you ever wonder if other people have some great satisfaction, some great and perfect fulfillment, and that you're the only one who feels anxious and disconsolate, as though you failed to completely materialize where everyone else has. Everyone else crossed the line, fully put themselves on, and went off to live their life, but you somehow slowed down before you crossed the line. You never quite got into the uniform of your own being. You sort of drizzled off into the woods. You weren't quite sure it was up something you're up to. I don't know if I want to wear the outfit of myself, the costume of who I am. What would that have been like? The strangest urge to go back to the store to be with the stocker uppers. I love their sense of purpose. I think I may be jealous. That may be the source of my irritation. So earlier when I was there, and they're all stocking up, filling up carts of breakfast cereal, cans of soup. I didn't even successfully buy one thing. I had a loaf of bread and butter, and then I put it back because the lines were too long. But now I find myself missing them, the stocker-uppers. Now, it's not that I'm lonely. But it is that I miss them. It's not that I'm lonely. It is that I miss them. And it's that I would one day hope to be as pleased and as innocent in the face of a small storm that I might allow myself to go haywire and fill some cart with oatmeal. In fact, my friends, I promise you this. You do something for me, I'll also do something for me. That's the sort of deal I like to strike. You go out of your way, to do something that, in a similar spirit, violates your own concept of self. And I will as well. So while there's still time left, I will head down to my little grocery store, which is open till 11. I will get one of the small carts. They have a very small cart there, smaller than any. It's a child's cart. It fits down their little aisles. And I will fill it with oatmeal, cans of tomato soup, enormous blocks of cheddar cheese, the largest box of crackers I can find, butter, water, candles, flashlights, batteries. I'll do it with a smile on my face. So, my friends, I must be off. I am tired, and it is late, but I must be stocking up. Always merry and bright to you all. Always merry and bright. It's time, and I'm late. The old frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll slip through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep. It's tired and I'm late. Untie your candles, I just lit the skates. We're sitting in sleepless light, come dreams that were seeping right. But now it's time to sweep.
Hit a ball now.
It's tired and I'm late. Your frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll sleep through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sweep.